5 o'clock.
Welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, with my co-host Delilah Jones, president of ImaginePublicity.com, welcoming you this Saturday evening and every Saturday to enlighten you, to educate you, to increase your awareness, and hopefully to entertain you as well, primarily about the aftermath of crime and the issues that surround it. And so I want to say welcome to everyone. If you're a repeat listener or if you're a newbie this evening, we have a very interesting show. And we do have a repeat guest. We don't have many of them, but tonight we have Dr. David Schoenfeld, who is our guest, who is going to speak on the topic of children and grieving and bereavement, primarily in the areas of dealing with all kinds of grieving, and some of it may be crime-based, others may be natural deaths, but specifically honing in on what to do in the educational realm, because oftentimes parents may not know what to do, and we have to turn to the educational system. And he has been, he has dedicated his career to working in this realm, as well as being a behavioral developmental pediatrician. So before I bring him on in just a minute, I want to say good evening, Delilah, and welcome, and how are you, and what's going on with Imagine Publicity this evening?
Oh, all kinds of things are always going on with Imagine Publicity. A lot of clients that, are working on several big projects, so that keeps us busy.
Yeah. You want to share just a nugget with somebody? Or should
we're looking.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think go to the website. This isn't the time and place to go in depth on that kind of thing. So.
All right. Give people your website.
Well, ImaginePublicity.com. Just check out all of our clients and what they're up to and what you can do with them in the future if you like.
Great. Okay. Well, that's great. We have been looking forward to our guest this evening, right? Because this is the second time we've had David on. And I think it's going to be a very valuable show. So without delaying it any further, David, thank you so much for being on Shattered Life the second time. It's a pleasure to have you.
It's nice to be here again.
Well, great. Let's see. We have many areas that we could discuss this evening, but why don't you give us a thumbnail sketch on actually what your area of expertise is, and go into the two primary realms that you're dealing with, both the Coalition and the National Center for School Crisis and Bereavement, if you would.
Well, certainly. Well, my training background is as a developmental behavioral pediatrician. It's a relatively new field, only been recognized as board certified for about a dozen years. It's a subspecialty of pediatrics that deals with common developmental and behavioral concerns. And so when I was doing my training over 25 years ago in developmental behavioral pediatrics, I actually became interested in how children come to understand and adjust to serious illness and death, and have concentrated a lot of my work in that area. So as you mentioned, I direct the National Center for School Crisis and Bereavement, which is currently located in Philadelphia. And we've provided support to schools and community groups after crisis events, as well as helped provide education and resources for learning about how to support grieving children. And one of the projects, as you alluded to, is the Coalition to Support Grieving Students.
Mm-hmm. Is it the only standalone center of its kind, or are there others like it? Or
well, there are bereavement centers around the country which provide support to children who are grieving. And, you know, if you're looking for a bereavement support group for a child, there are a number of centers around the country. Many of them belong to the National Alliance of Grieving Children. And you can actually go on to achildingrief.com and get a map of the country and find a bereavement center near you or a bereavement program such as bereavement camp. But our center doesn't provide direct services to children who are grieving, but instead provides consultation and training and advocacy work to try and enhance children's supports in their caring communities, particularly schools, so that when they're dealing with crisis and loss, they're surrounded by adults that know how to support them. And that I'm not aware of another center that has quite that focus. There are a mm-hmm. number of centers that also provide trauma and crisis services and do, you know, research and training in trauma and crisis. But I'm not familiar with another center that has a focus on schools that brings together those areas of both crisis and bereavement.
Mm-hmm. Well, could you venture to say that you've had requests to consult in virtually all 50 states with all of the mass shootings and level of violence that we've had, say, maybe within the last 10-15 years?
Well, we've certainly responded to a large number of school crisis events and provided training throughout the country, as well as abroad. We've been to a number of other countries. I don't know that we've gone to all 50 states yet. You know, for example, I haven't been to Alaska yet, but I think we've certainly had impact on people who are from all 50 states if they've attended national conferences and the coalition that we helped to put together and helped to lead, the Coalition to Support Grieving Students, has 10 professional organizations that represent a number of different school professions, and together they have just under 5 million members. So I'm sure one of them must come from Alaska, but we haven't made it around. I personally have never, you know, I haven't been to Alaska.
And haven't been there.
There's probably a couple other states we haven't had as much of a direct impact on, mm-hmm. but we do our best to try and provide some national coverage.
Right, and Just to mention briefly, we in the state of Connecticut became aware of you because of Governor Malloy's commission with the Sandy Hook massacre, correct?
Yes. Well, I was invited to come to Newtown shortly after the shooting and was there that weekend. And provided some support in the initial week. And in part related to that, I was invited to be a member of the Sandy Hook Advisory Commission. We just mm-hmm. completed a report, the final report, to the governor just a couple weeks ago. But we were meeting regularly since shortly after the shooting had occurred until quite recently.
At least a couple of years. And there were quite a number of mental health recommendations there as well with regard to, you know, what to do in the future. And the fact remains, though, we don't know whether with budget cuts we're going to be able to implement them. And I'm sure it has been very upsetting for parents. And I'm reading in our newspapers here that there, you know, parents are upset, but we have to make hard choices. So, and I'm sure that's part of it. But I'm wondering, with respect to the Coalition to Support Grieving Students, can you describe for us how that came to be and you identified a particular need, and how did it evolve?
Certainly. Well, a lot of the reason for setting up the National Center for School Crisis and Bereavement, which was initially funded from the September 11th Children's Fund and the National Philanthropic Trust in 2005, it was initiated because I really felt, and the others that worked with me, that we needed to try and advocate more to get school professionals better prepared and more comfortable in supporting children who had experienced loss or who were dealing with crisis. This came about in part because I had been doing work in this area for quite some time, and after September 11th, 2001, I was asked by the New York City school system to coordinate the training for their school crisis teams throughout the system. And New York City schools is a very large school system. They had, at the time, I know it was about 1.1 million students in about 1,200 schools that were, at that time, divided into over 40 school districts. And so we developed a strategy for training the school, the school system. And that meant we set up a citywide school crisis team, as well as train teams in each of the over 40 school districts, and then train teams in over 1,000 schools. And we did this training through live in-person full-day training workshops.
So was it a train-the-trainer model?
It wasn't as much a train-the-trainer model as we trained district-level teams, and then we also trained school-based teams. But the idea was to try and implement teams throughout the system pretty much at all at around the same time. I mean, we started the district teams first, but the school crisis teams came within a month. And somebody came up to me after one of those trainings and said, you know, it really would be a good idea if all of the teachers or classroom educators participated in at least part of this training, and specifically around the bereavement, I think was what they had pointed out. And I asked them how many people that was, and by that person's estimate, if you included the paraprofessionals in the class, I think it was around 120 or 130,000 people just in the New York City school system. And at that point, I kind of said, well, wouldn't it make more sense if educators learned some of this before they got their license or before they graduated from education school? Wouldn't it make sense that this was integrated within the training of all educators and school professionals, because you have to anticipate that you're going to be working with children who've experienced loss or crisis. It's just so much a part of the life of children everywhere that you know you're going to have them in your classroom. Wouldn't it make sense to get some of that training beforehand? Some of that was actually just my sense of I couldn't possibly go around and do much more training than I was doing. And so that was the idea behind the funding of the National Center for School Crisis and Bereavement. It was really to try and make those changes. And so that was back in 2005, and now we're, 10 years later. And we've done a number of different things, a number of projects, and developed training materials, and gotten information out in a number of venues. But one of the projects that we did was with the American Federation of Teachers several years ago, and they polled their members, surveyed over 1,000 of their members, and educators said that they had children who were grieving in their classes, that they knew that it was an important issue that impacted on their learning, their adjustment, their development, their behavior. They also knew that schools could play a unique role to complement and support families and to help these kids, and they wanted to do that. But they said that the primary reason that they didn't was that they had never received the training. Only about 7% had received any training, and those who had generally gotten it for themselves, because only about 3% of the school districts were reported to have any training in this area. So
there's nothing incorporated in the curriculum, now, that would even deal with one course on death and dying or grieving or something?
It's not standardized. And it's hard for us to know what's being offered where, but at least by the teachers' reports, only 7% said they had gotten any training, whether that was in graduate school, undergraduate, or in professional development after they were in the field. So we have to think that the vast majority are not getting this information in any significant amount.
Right.
And so often what happens is school professionals do nothing. We find often that they don't even talk to the children, sometimes not even acknowledging that they know they've had a death of a family member or a friend, because they're afraid they're going to do the wrong thing or make things worse, so they do nothing, mm-hmm. which is probably the worst thing to do, because mm-hmm. it suggests to children that either you don't care, you don't think it's important, or you're unprepared or worse yet, unwilling to even try and help them. And that means that the kids end up grieving alone and are isolated and unsupported. So mm-hmm. that's why we established the Coalition to Support Grieving Students, was to bring together the professions that could help kids.
In the years that you've been doing this, I don't know, have you gone back and looked at some of the children and followed their history and so forth to maybe put together statistics as to the children who received these services versus those who did not? Did they do so much better within their psychological life, or how can you, is there any measurement, or right. does there even need to be?
Well, I mean, the issue is that if you do surveys of children and ask what percent of them have had personal loss, the estimates, we know about 4 to 5% of U.S. children experience the death of a parent by the time they're 16. That's by U.S. Census data. But in terms of how many have experienced the death of a family member or friend, the survey suggests it's about 90%. So virtually all children by the time they complete high school. So it's not really, you really can't identify children who have experienced loss and those who have not, because loss is so common. In terms of whether we have had an impact, the vast majority of our work, and virtually all of it at this point, is through training of professionals. It isn't through direct service to the children. My belief, and that of the people in our center, is that the best way to support children is to have those who know, care, and love them support them, not to have strangers kind of descend on a school after a crisis and provide direct service. That's not to say that after a crisis it isn't useful to have other people throughout the school district and the community come and support kids. I'm more referring if there was a crisis in Alaska and I did respond, for me to go to Alaska and walk into a school and come up to a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old, or even a 15-year-old, and to start to talk to them and try and support them, and then to leave a day or two later and not to return, doesn't really help them as much as if I spend that time with professionals and paraprofessionals and others that are part of that community and help empower them to feel more comfortable supporting these children, because they're with them in the long run mm-hmm. and often have already established the relationship, but certainly are there to maintain the relationship. So,
and are they receptive, David? Are they welcoming, or it's like, oh my God, I have to do Common Core and I have to do this and I have to, and now it's another thing. But I wouldn't think, because this is so important, that probably it is very well received. Am I correct?
It's variable, as you would imagine.
Okay.
I'm finding that increasingly educators and other school professionals recognize the importance of this and are looking for more training and improved skills in this area. And that was mm-hmm. one of the things that we did with the American Federation of Teachers. I mean, at the national level, they recognized years ago that this was important, but they thought it was important that the request for the training came from their membership as opposed to being told by the leadership that this was what, we mm-hmm. thought educators should get. So
right.
Our first project with the American Federation of Teachers actually had us working with a number of selected AFT chapters across the country, and within a fairly short period of time, feedback came back to the national office that this was really important, and they allowed the members to tell other members that this was something that was really useful. And then once the membership was requesting this, then that's when we moved to the Coalition to Support Grieving Students project.
Oh, I see. Well, yeah, that certainly sounds like maybe you don't go in like gangbusters, but you kind of, you know, build your credibility there, and then they pass the word. It certainly sounds like the way to go. I'm wondering if maybe you can talk briefly about the some of the concepts of death with regard to children that you did in the 12-minute video that I watched, and maybe some of the content of the modules, and get into the content and what people might anticipate if they want to go in and see some of the materials.
Certainly. Well, let me start by explaining just a little bit more about the Coalition and the website,
oh, sure,
and then
I'll
talk some about the content.
Okay.
The Coalition is actually formed of 10 organizations. It includes the two major teacher unions, which is the American Federation of Teachers, AFT, but it's also the National Education Association, the NEA. We also realized and recognized that if we did training for educators and they felt more comfortable doing some bereavement support. And I want to clarify, we're not training teachers to be mental health professionals or to provide bereavement counseling. We're actually just helping them provide support to children who are grieving. So it's a much more practically oriented, basic skills approach because the teachers already understand child development and they're empathic to begin with, otherwise
right.
they wouldn't be in their field. So we just want to make them feel a little more comfortable to continue to be empathic and supportive even when a child is grieving. So we have, for them to be able to do that, they really need to have the support and the encouragement of their school administrators. So there are four different school administration organizations that are part of the Coalition. It includes the National Association of both Elementary School and Secondary School Principals, the American Federation of School Administrators, and the School Superintendents Association. So that's six of the organizations, and the other four, the National Association for School Nurses, the School Social Work Association of America, the American School Counselors Association, and the National Association of School Nurses. So what we tried to do is to put together some of the major organizations that include educators, paraprofessionals, school administrators, school mental health providers, and other support personnel. So,
social workers and guidance counselors included as well?
Yes, the School Social Work Association of America is one of the founding members. And the other member, which I didn't mention, is the New York Life Foundation. They're one of the founding partners, and they also provided the support for the project. So those organizations have come together, and we've been meeting for about a year and a half, and we've developed material that can be freely accessed at grievingstudents.org. And at that website are a number of probably about 20 or so individual video modules that are also accompanied by print summaries, and they cover a range of different topics related to pediatric bereavement and how to support students. So one of them that you had mentioned was the video that went over children's concepts about death, because we know particularly for young children, their understanding of death is limited by their cognitive development. And for them to be able to maximally cope and adjust to a loss, they need to understand certain things about it. So the research really suggests that there are four major concepts, and those concepts are that the first one is that death is irreversible. So when someone dies, they don't come back to life again. In television shows and in books, sometimes the characters do come back to life. But in reality, they don't. And children need to understand that death is irreversible. Otherwise, they may just wait for the person to come back or be upset that they haven't returned or contacted them, such as for special occasions. But you really have no reason to begin to begin the process of adjusting to a death and grieving until you realize that it is irreversible. So that's one of the earliest concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, while it's very difficult to accept that someone who has died is not coming back, it's actually not that complicated cognitively to understand that. If you think about it, very young children, one of the phrases that they struggle to, you know, that they all learn, is often you'll find it in baby books. But it's usually, there's a picture of a baby turning over an empty bowl, and, you know, it says underneath, all gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's
gotcha.
Something
gotcha.
That a lot of kids learn. And, you know, we'll say, all gone, and they know that means it's gone. It's not coming back. And so I remember explaining a close family member's death to my child when she was about 20 months old, and she didn't really understand the word death yet. I hadn't taught it to her. And finally, I tried different ways, and then I finally said, the person is all gone. And she looked at me and she said, all gone? And then she went over to the bag where a baby book was. She took it out. She turned it to the page where the child, you know, turns over the bowl and says, all gone. And she just said the person's name and said, all gone? And I said, yes, all gone. And at
wow.
that point, she never asked to see her again. She
really?
Understood that meant she was all gone. So mm-hmm. I just use that as an example because people will say, you know, young children can never understand that death is irreversible. Actually, they can at pretty young ages understand it. They may not wish to or be ready to accept it, but that happens with adults too. So
mm-hmm.
the second concept that they need to understand is that all life functions end completely at the time of death. So when someone dies, everything that makes them alive ends completely. So young children appreciate the fact that when someone's dead, they're not fully alive, but they may not really understand what life functions are and know that they end completely. So they may say that people who are dead can't move as much. And when you ask them why, they might say, well, the coffin is small, or there's not enough room in the coffin to move, or they may view them as if they're asleep, and but not that all of their life functions end. So if you think about it, you know, initially children think everything that's alive, everything that exists is alive. We call that animism. So if you kick the door, you know, the door might hurt. And then, you know, their stuffed animal can be hungry. And then they start to realize that only things that have certain characteristics, for example, that move, are alive. But then, you know, the car is alive, but a plant isn't, or may not be viewed as being alive. And so they might say, well, it's self-locomotion. But then, of course, a robot might be seen as alive. And again, a tree might not be seen as alive. So they
very confusing for even an adult versus a child.
Yeah, so it really, if you think about it, it takes some understanding to be able to sort out, you know, what makes something alive. And then and then you can know, okay, well, all of those things stop. So if you have a child who's, say, 4 years old and you ask them to draw a picture to put in the casket with a loved one who's died, that may imply to a child that the person in the casket can see it. I mean, otherwise, why would you draw a picture for someone you care about and give it to them after they've dead if they can't actually see it? You know,
right.
We may understand that as being abstract, but from a child, they're very concrete. So if it means that the individual who's died is aware that there's a picture and can see it, that means they are also aware that they're in a box and that they're underground and that they're trapped. And so you'll find
true.
That children may actually be very concerned about physical suffering of deceased. And if you think about the horror stories for children at that age, or that are often written for children in general, but are viewed by even young children, there's a lot of, you know, vampires, zombies, living dead, hands coming out of the grave, people buried alive. It's just a common theme. So we really need children to understand that all life functions cease completely at the time of death so that they don't worry about the physical suffering of deceased. And then the third concept is that everything that's alive eventually dies. We just call it, it's inevitable. And it's a hard concept to kind of teach a child right after they've experienced a death.
Hello?
I think we just lost David. He's been disconnected. His call was dropped. Hopefully call right back in.
Okay.
But I think this is a terribly important discussion that should benefit a lot of the listeners. I'm sure there's a lot of parents out there who and teachers and educators that will definitely benefit from this conversation.
Oh, I totally agree, and I want to ask if perhaps there are, I know that there are webinars as well as publications, and they also can do conference presentations, but are there lessons that they can incorporate, like into the daily lesson plans or something with the teachers, just to kind of introduce the children to these things? I would think that would be valuable as well. So,
absolutely. Here we have David back now. Your call dropped.
Oh, good. Are you there?
Okay, yes. I'm sorry. I don't know why that happened. So
the cloud just dropped. We're very sorry. Nothing personal.
Okay. So did you want me to pick up and finish those last two things?
Yeah,
or?
You were talking about the third concept.
Right, and that's that death is inevitable. And what I was saying is that if children don't realize that everyone eventually dies, if they somehow think certain people are excluded, such as themselves or people that they care about, then when someone they care about dies, they have to ask themselves, well, why was that person selected? If it's if it's not inevitable, there was a choice. Someone made that choice. And usually children will conclude that someone they care about was killed because they were bad, and which means you should be ashamed of the person that died, and there's some fault associated with it. Or the child may assume that the child themselves, did something wrong, and as a form of punishment, someone they care about was killed, in which case they'll feel guilty. And with the guilt and the shame usually comes silence. And so understanding that, no, it is actually inevitable and it's part of life, actually helps them have a better understanding of the cause of death and less likelihood to feel guilty or ashamed. And that's the fourth concept, is just a sense of the cause of death. And so if children understand the real cause of the death at least a basic level, they're less likely to associate shame or guilt with it. So those are the four concepts, and we found that if children understand those four concepts, they're more likely to be able to cope with the death.
And how are those taught? If parents are not enlightened to be able to understand the children's cognitive level, and the one comment I remember you saying on the video about them, their body being in the coffin, but the child somehow disassociated and thought that maybe the head was missing, because you talk about it as the body. So how do children learn these? How long does it take to learn them?
Well, on average, most children will learn these concepts between 5 and 7 years of age. And that's without any particular education aimed at teaching it. We know that children, the research that I did in my fellowship training actually was to see if you could teach children these concepts through classroom-based presentations. Mm-hmm. I was working with 4 to 8 year olds, and actually they do learn them. It's within their capability of learning them at younger ages. And children who have experienced losses tend to advance more quickly and understand them at younger ages. But as you mentioned, it's not only that we don't consciously teach this to children or even try to explain it to them in ways that help them understand it better. They actually are exposed to a lot of misinformation. And, if you think about the stories that children are told at young ages, it's almost as if it was designed to make them not understand it. I mean, I can give you an example if you'd like of,
sure.
of common things. Well, if you think about Snow White, I'm not trying to pick on Snow White, but I remember going to see it when it was re-released.
He's dropped again. This is unusual.
Oh, my goodness. I'm so embarrassed.
Well, it happens, and I don't believe it's on our end. I think it may be
nope.
on his end.
Well, I'm
can you hear
you.
Me?
I can hear you. I hope
okay. So you and I are both yep. here. But
yeah.
He,
but
again, his call has dropped, so hopefully he'll call in again.
Video? I know. My goodness. Yeah. So there are up to 20 modules that I believe take about 3 to 4 hours. But the beauty of it is that if you are to go in and listen, even if you are a parent or an educator or an advocate of some type, they're 10 minutes long, and they're very interactive. And so I'm thinking that even though if you are a parent listening, you can refer your school system, and that's what I wanted to ask, to say, hey, I'd like you to take a look at this. I think it would be very valuable to
right.
feature this in our school, and what can we do?
Well,
I am back again,
now?
By
Maybe
the way.
You can answer that question.
Okay.
I am
yes.
so sorry. I don't know why I keep getting dropped. I'm on a landline, so it shouldn't be happening. But,
I know. Well, our apologies again. We'll just cross our fingers. It's the last time.
Yes.
So
I was starting
Go
to
ahead.
Talk about Snow White as an example. I was
yes, Snow White.
I was with my daughter. I think she was probably 4 at the time, and Snow White had been re-released. This was quite some time ago, and she was sitting in my lap, and I'm watching the movie. And if you think about the theme, it's about a girl whose mother has died. She is then placed into a blended family. There are a lot of children in blended families. It's unfortunate that in this case the mother wants to kill her because she's too beautiful, and she somehow feels threatened by that. So that's not a good way to present a model blended family to children. And so the girl's coping mechanism, she's not able to turn to another adult or somebody that she can trust for support and assistance. She has to actually flee for her life because someone is trying to come and kill her and cut out her heart, which is obviously already pretty troubling. And so what happens then is she escapes into the woods. She's then pursued with someone trying to murder her at the request of her mother, stepmother at this point. And the stepmother then comes up with a plan that she will turn herself into an ugly old hag, is the way she describes it, which really is not a very good way to represent the elderly. And again, it's this theme that those who are beautiful are to be trusted and those who are ugly are not.
Right.
And so what she's going to do then is find her daughter, and she's going to give her an apple. I don't know why it couldn't have been junk food of some sort. Why we have to make them fear fruits and vegetables. So she's going to give her an apple, and it has been magic has been used. Magic is very kind of frightening, can be very frightening to children because they don't understand it, can't predict it. And then when she bites the apple, you know, then what's going to happen to her? And I kind of remembered that she was going to die. But no, this, you know, her stepmother says she will fall into an everlasting sleep, and the dwarfs, thinking that she is dead, will bury her alive. Now, at that point, I was just, that goes right into really the what we call the finality of death, knowing that all life functions cease at the time of death, and the concept of being buried alive is very frightening, particularly when you don't quite know the difference between being asleep and being dead. And my daughter slept well through the night, and I didn't want that to stop. So in the middle of the movie, kind of whispered to her, dear, you do know that we do not bury people when they're sleeping. We know the difference. And she kind of said to me in this, you know, very soft whisper that everyone could hear in the theater, Dad, it is just a movie. It's pretend. Of course I know there's a difference between asleep and dead. Just listen, you know, just watch the movie. So then what happens is she does bite the apple. She falls into this everlasting sleep. But the dwarf, thinking she is so beautiful, even in death, decide to bury her in a glass coffin above ground so they can sit and watch her dead body, which is a pretty disturbing idea to begin with. But then I think even more disturbing is that this prince, rides by on his horse, decides she is so beautiful even in death that he opens the coffin and kisses a strange dead body. Now that in itself should be disturbing for anyone, but then she awakens and decides that he is so handsome, is not disturbed by the fact that he kissed a strange dead body, and decides that he is so handsome and powerful because he's rich that she will marry him and rides off to the castle, which would be the last thing I would want my daughter to do if with a stranger who would do something like that. So if you think about it, that's the stories that these kids
are
exposed to. So
it's kind of article about this. I mean, really.
Well, and if you think about a lot of the other stories, deaths are very common themes in fairy tales and in stories written for children. And the thing is that it's almost surprising that they ever get it right, given what they're being exposed to. And now there's been some suggestion. There was a researcher that looked into this, who's a child psychiatrist by the name of Lenore Tair, and she found that some of the people that write horror stories actually experienced deaths when they were at the ages when they were learning these concepts, and that they keep telling the stories almost like they need to reprocess that experience. And one of the reasons they're so effective and they become successful is because a lot of these horror stories tie into these concepts. And so, you know, there's a lot of people who will write stories about, vampires, zombies, living dead. And they're scary because and if you watch those stories, they often involve children being attacked, people being attacked in their sleep, confusing death with sleep or it being somehow blurred. So a lot of this does seem to have to do with children's emerging concepts about death and fears associated with that.
We know then we have to debrief children when they watch fairy tales then. I mean, that's kind of, it didn't occur to me, and I somehow got over that period because I know I saw that movie. But what makes the difference? Is it resilience? Is it the way you're brought up in that some children will be traumatized and get the wrong ideas and others will not? What makes the difference?
Well, I think in terms of understanding concepts about death is children will develop an understanding of it, even if they're not taught it, just by experiencing life. So I had a friend who had a 2-year-old, and he came across a frog that had been run over in the street. She was telling me this because she knew of my work in this area. And the boy said something like, you know, froggy dead. And the mother said, no, the frog's not dead. The frog's just asleep. And I think she was telling me that because she thought that was a good answer. But actually, the last thing I would want a child to think is that they look like that frog that had been run over by a car when they go to sleep. I mean, or that would happen to them. So I said, well, what did your child say? And she said, for some reason, he just kept saying, mommy, frog not sleep, frog dead. And so here the mother was giving the wrong information, but the child knew it was wrong. So I think for a lot of kids, it's not so much that they're resilient by learning these concepts. It's that the concepts are right, and it is what happens in life. And so they figure it out through their life experiences, and although they may get misinformation, they also have other sources of correct information. I think the issue comes when they experience a personal loss, whether or not they're resilient, and some of that may be from what they understand, but it probably even is more important that they have someone that supports them and that they have other supportive you know, resources and internal capacity to cope that helps them with the resiliency.
Yeah. Are there opportunities with your program to, when you train the educators, to do lessons that they incorporate like every day so that they could pass on some of this? Like, I always loved having circle, you know, and when you do, I mean, is that kind of how it's geared so that they could not only be supportive when there is a personal loss, but also educate the children informally to some of these concepts that may be confusing?
Sure. Well, when I did my research project, I actually wrote a curriculum and taught it. Believe it or not, the children enjoyed it. They wanted to talk about it. Now, these were 4 to 8 year olds. It was pre-kindergarten to second grade. And the kids, you know, really appreciated the opportunity to talk about something that was important to them. Having said that, though, we're not really encouraging teachers to teach a curriculum about death. Particularly to the young children who would be learning these concepts, but rather to take advantage of naturally occurring experiences and comments. So, you know, I remember when my daughter was, I think she was in kindergarten or could have been in preschool, and my wife said, you know, why don't you ask your daughter what she's bringing to show and tell? And so I said, well, what are you bringing to show and tell? And it was a stuffed animal. And so I'm like, okay, she's bringing a stuffed dog to show and tell. And so my wife said, well, why don't you ask her what she's going to say? And I said, well, what are you going to tell the class? And she said, I'm going to tell the class that this was a stuffed animal that was made by my dead grandmother. Now, she had two grandmothers. One was alive and one was dead. And so my wife looked at me and said, well, what should she do? You know, what are we going to do? And I go, what do you mean, what are we going to do? And she said, well, if she goes to class and says she's got this stuffed animal from her grandmother who's dead, you know, what's going to happen? And I said, well, two things could happen. One is the teacher could use that as an opportunity to talk about how she might miss her grandmother who's dead or what it means when someone dies. Or the other is that the teacher's going to ignore it and just start talking about the stuffed animal, which is obviously the less educational and probably less relevant point.
Or they think that people who are dead can make animals.
Right. Well, it was given to her before. It was made by by her grandmother beforehand. Well, yes, I think they did get that because I think they were 4 or 5. But
I'm being devil's advocate here.
Yeah. What actually happened was what I expected, which was the teacher just talked about the stuffed animal and kind of ignored the learning opportunity there. And that's, I think, they didn't say anything about her grandmother. And that's why my daughter brought it. I mean, she didn't bring it because the stuffed animal was made by her grandmother, but otherwise that was the only special thing about it, was who made it. It wasn't the stuffed animal itself.
Well, don't you think this teacher must have thought, again, as you were saying, oh, this is uncharted territory, this is sensitive, we have to be politically correct and not broach this topic with them because, you know, God forbid we haven't been trained, and so I'm just not going to say anything.
Well, a lot of times teachers tell me, you know, they're afraid that they're going to upset the children because if they ask, you know, if somebody says, my mother died, and you say, oh, how are you doing? And the kid starts crying, you think you've upset them. I keep explaining that you're not upsetting the child. The child's upset because of the death. If you ask them how they feel and they start crying, all they've done is show you how they were already feeling. You didn't cause
those feelings. Emotional release, right? That opportunity.
And so then they say, well, I'm afraid I'm going to say the wrong thing. So then I go over, well, what are the wrong things? And, you know, to be quite honest, I give advice to people about what are things you would want to avoid saying and what are things that probably are more appropriate to say. The bottom line is it's like the fairy tales and children's stories. They get a lot of misinformation, and there's a lot of things we say as adults that aren't ideal. I may even be wrong from time to time, but what's most important is we care and we're there for them, and we show that concern.
Well, you want to give us a couple of examples that you might give just so
sure.
that people know?
And so a couple of things that are commonly said and probably should be avoided, and this is in the context of when it's a professional, like a teacher, who's supporting a child. It's very different if you're talking about something you might say to a friend, a colleague. I'm really referring to when there's somebody who's the child is the focus, and the adult is there because it's their job, you know. So in that situation, you know, as my kids taught me, it's all about the kid. You know, it's not a mutual relationship where you're supposed to gain as much. You're supposed to be helping the kid. So in that situation, I would avoid things like trying to cheer the child up. This is probably the most common approach, is that anything that begins with at least should probably be reconsidered. You know, at least he's not in pain anymore. At least you still have your mother. At least you were able to spend the holidays together. To say that pretty much it belittles the loss. It minimizes the loss. And it's really just that the child is grieving and the adult doesn't want to see it because it makes them uncomfortable. So they try and cheer up the child so they stop crying or looking upset.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a common one, and these apply to adults too. It's not just kids. Another one would be to tell them you know how they feel. You know, you must be angry. You shouldn't be telling people how they should feel. You should be asking them how they feel. You also, this is one where it may be more appropriate when you're talking with a peer or a family member, but I think a lot of times we try and make comparisons. And whenever we do that, when we compare and share our own personal experiences, one of two things happens. Either what we say pales by comparison and it's insulting. So I had a nurse tell a family when their child had died of sudden infant death syndrome, "I know what you're going through. My dog died this weekend." So that's just the family was just insulted that their death of their child would be compared to the nurse's death of a dog. But the opposite can also occur, where a child says, "My dog died," and you said, "Oh, I know, you know, I can understand that, you know, my mother just died this weekend." Then the child has to turn around and support the teacher or whatever adult said that, because then it doesn't seem right to talk about your loss when the other person's loss is worse. So.
Would you say
I wouldn't make the comparison
comparable? The loss needs to be somewhat equitable. If it's, "Oh, my dog died," "Oh, well, my cat died," "My grandma died," "Oh, well, my mother died."
But
something
even when
like
you
that.
Do that, even if it's comparable, then what happens is that means that the support should go both ways, and you're burdening the person who's acutely grieving to have to support you.
I understand what you're saying.
You might do that if it's your brother that you're talking to or a friend.
Yeah, but not a teacher or teacher-child.
But a teacher taking care of a child,
it's
all about them. The
person
getting the support's the kid. And that's why I said my kids taught me sometimes it's just all about them. And if they're really upset about something and I try and tell them what happened to work, you know, at work for me, it's kind of like, "I don't really care what happened at work. I'm telling you what happened to me. I need help." So when somebody's acutely grieving, it's really best to just focus on them and what they need.
Right. That's good. We have about 6 minutes or so left. Can you give us an overview of some of the content of the modules?
Certainly. And I should say these modules are such that you can go online and you can just watch one or two. You don't have to go through all of them. It's not a set curriculum. So we have so they're in six different areas, and one is on conversation and support. So it's on how to talk to children. There's one on what not to say. In the talking with children, we actually have some video clips of actors that we used, where one is playing the role of an educator and the other of a child. We have one of a young child and an older child. And so they kind of act out. And we a scenario where the educator is talking to the child for the first time after they've come back to school. So that might be useful for some people to watch, even if they're not in school settings. We talk about providing support over time and really the role of peer support and how to assist with that. We have one section on developmental and cultural considerations, and so we talk about the concepts of death, as I already mentioned. We talk about the importance of connecting with families and issues around cultural sensitivity. We have a third section that deals with more kind of practical considerations, such as advice around funeral attendance, the issues of secondary losses. You know, when somebody dies, the person loses not only the individual they care about, but they also lose everything that person might do or had done for them. So if a mother dies 6 years later when the girl enters puberty, for example, she may now realize that she's lost the person who might have helped guide her through that experience. And that's then a secondary loss. We also talk about cumulative losses, about particularly communities where there are multiple losses, trying to dispel the myth that, you know, kids who have experienced a lot of loss just get used to it. They don't actually just get used to it. They actually just realize that the adults around them aren't going to provide them the support, so they stop asking for it. But they actually just are multiply traumatized by those events. We talk about coordinating services and supporting transitions for kids that are moving from one school to another, such as at graduation. And then we talk some about social media and its role in supporting children who are grieving. And then we talk about grief reactions and grief triggers, guilt and shame, other reactions, and what kind of anniversary reactions and other triggers. We have a section on professional preparation and self-care. And then we have the last section is on crisis and other special circumstances. Talk about death occurring in a school of a student or staff member and school crisis response, suicide, commemoration and memorialization. And then we have a module on potentially life-limiting conditions when children attend school, when they are have serious illnesses that might be terminal or fatal.
Wow. So those are the... It really does cover the whole gamut then. Yeah.
Right. And then we have a range of other additional resources that are there, booklets that can be downloaded, guidance documents. That's in an additional resources section. And we continue to add to that section as well.
Well, that's great. If someone is listening and they happen to be an educator, can they, or alternately, I know it's not specifically designed for parents, but can they somehow bring this to their school system's attention and say, hey, I'd like to see you incorporate some of this material, or can we somehow, use it? How does somebody go about that if they're listening now and they'd like to make use of it?
Just go to grievingstudents.org, and the material that's there is available for free download. So each of the video modules also has print summaries, and those summaries can be photocopied and distributed. And there is a number of other materials in the additional resources section which also can be photocopied, and a number of them which can be ordered at no charge from achildingrief.com. So that's a website that the New York Life Foundation has established, and their booklets on how to talk to a child who's grieving that goes over a lot of what I discussed, some of which I wrote or co-wrote. And those materials are not only freely downloadable in a PDF format, but you can actually order free copies from the New York Life Foundation, and they even pay at this point postage and handling, kind of as a community service. One of the booklets, for example, has already been translated into Spanish, and as well as some in hard copies that can be ordered. Mm-hmm. But they've also been translated into other languages as well.
Well, that's very good. You can't get any better than free. And are you also available if people have a question? I mean, in terms of consultation or an email, or if they want to ask you about a particular thing or to consult with your school system?
The National Center for School Crisis and Bereavement provides free technical assistance and consultation to schools in crisis situations. And you can contact us at our toll-free number, 877-536-2722. Or if you go to grievingstudents.org, our information is listed there. And you can also just email info@grievingstudents.org. And that phone number comes to me, and that email address comes to me as well, so and others at the center. So we're happy to help people. Our primary role, though, is to support schools, so we don't call for an appointment for your child because we don't see the children for individual bereavement counseling, but we can we could help you find one in your community.
I understand. Well, that sounds just great. And unfortunately, and we're very sorry about the 2-drop calls, but we're going to have to close out for this hour. But will you stay in touch with me? Perhaps we could do another show at some other time in the future.
Sure. Happy
We'd
to
like
help.
That? Well, that'd be great. Well, so thank you so very much. Delilah, have any parting comments?
I think, it was just such a wonderful time to have a conversation with Dr. Schoenfeld. And I think there is so much information out there for educators, parents, and things that children need. And hopefully our listeners will pick up the ball and run with it.
Right. And I'm going to promote that, too, after the show as well, so that they will, hopefully, and repeat it. And be sure to listen on the archives as well. It's always available. So thank you so much, David. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of your evening, all of you listeners, and we'll stay tuned next Saturday for another edition of Shattered Lives.